Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Of course, we've all heard that police are saying Josh Powell killed himself and his two sons on Sunday. The boys ran into the house. Josh Powell apparently pushed the social worker out, locked the door. 3 minutes later, the social worker reports the house was in flames. Susan Cox Powell remains missing. We'll talk about this latest tragic chapter in the sad case with several guests this hour, and we're looking for your comments as well through this hour as we all try to come to terms with this. We'll talk with Susan Powell friends Kiersey Halliwell. We'll also talk with Sherry Hill, spokeswoman for the Children's Administration at the Washington State Department of Social and Health Services. There are some questions that some have. The department is anticipating those about how the visitation works and could there have been more done. We'll get comments from Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff. He's been talking about the limits of law enforcement and other aspects of this case. And we'll talk with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Sheena McFarland to get some background and context in this case. And we begin with the latest news from a couple of reporters covering this on the ground there. Seattle Times reporter Jennifer Sullivan joins us, and joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Nate Carlisle as well in this part of the program. As I mentioned, you are welcome to join us in this conversation. We invite you to do so at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. Our email is upraxcess@gmail.com, upraxcess@gmail.com, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. We bring in our reporter, Seattle Times reporter Jennifer Sullivan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Salt Lake Tribune reporter Nate Carlisle, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Let me start with you, Jennifer Sullivan. This, of course, has on occasion, fairly often, been front page or close to front page news over this whole case, over the 2 years of it in Utah. Where has it been on the radar of Washington residents?
I think it's been something we've all been aware of. And obviously, a lot of the TV reporters have been covering it, but it's happened in Pierce County, which is it's south of King County, where Seattle is located. We've covered it. We've kept it on the radar, but it's just been one of those stories we've watched from afar.
And situate this for us in Utah. Puyallup, how far away is that from Seattle?
Oh, a good 45 minutes with traffic, maybe over an hour.
Mm-hmm. And it'd be a little closer to Tacoma, I guess.
Much closer to Tacoma.
Mm-hmm. But basically in the general larger Seattle area, I guess.
It is, the Puget Sound region.
Yeah. Let me turn to Nate Carlisle. We have been reading the reports, of course, of the tragic incidents of Sunday. I mentioned just the broad outlines of this. There was a news conference or two yesterday. What have we learned new about what happened, what the police think happened there?
Well, was emphasized how much Josh planned this entire episode. Police found 2 5-gallon gas cans inside the house, which they believed is what Josh used to set the fire. He had donated children's clothing in advance of the boys arriving, and he made other arrangements about how he was supposed to how his survivors were supposed to distribute his assets. And then, of course, the medical examiner's report said that there were chop wounds to both of the boys that police are saying appears to be from a hatchet.
Yeah, and that's news that we didn't have yesterday. Jennifer Sullivan, what stood out to you from those the press conference and what the police are saying?
I think the most crucial element of the entire day, we started noticing early in the day, things just kept getting crazier and crazier. You had every news conference, the news got worse and worse. And I think when we heard the news about the hatchet last night, I think every TV reporter in the Seattle area just had to stop and kind of catch their breath. I mean, it's just something you can't even comprehend.
Nate Carlisle, what about this, the word we've been getting, it seems like just quite recently, the boys apparently had started talking to their grandparents about that night in 2009 when Susan Cox Powell went missing.
Well, it wasn't to their grandparents. A lot of people seem to be confused on this. What happened was, according to the Cox attorney, a teacher in Charlie's class asked the students to draw a picture of something they do in the summertime. And Charlie's picture depicted his father's driving, Charlie and his brother in the back seat of the car, and for some reason, Mom was in the trunk. And And then someone asked a follow-up question about this, and Charlie said something to the effect of they went camping, and mom got out, and mom got lost. And this was reported to law enforcement. We don't know whatever came of it.
Actually, to add to that is that a lawyer in Seattle, Ann Bremner, who's been representing the Cox family, said that Chuck Cox told her right around Christmas time in an email that one of the boys was telling her that mommy's in the mine. And that's what Ms. Bremner kept telling a lot of the media up here yesterday.
Hmm. Now, at the time of 2009, I think Charlie was two or three. So pretty young.
He was four, I believe.
Oh, he was four. No word on what Braden has been saying.
I don't know that Braden said anything. Mm-hmm. One important point to remember here is that Charlie was interviewed very early on by police. And we don't know the extent of what he said then, but we do know that he at least corroborated the camping trip. So I don't know to what extent this is really new.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So the police have had this for a while. Have there been questions? Have there been questions among just water cooler talk about, and Attorney General Mark Shurtleff here in Utah, we're going to have him on a little later, talked about the limits of law enforcement. But I don't know if there's been talk to you at reporters about what police should have done. Whether they maybe should have moved faster. Of course, this is all in hindsight now.
We haven't heard anything up here.
Mm-hmm.
As far as what police could have done, they've been investigating Josh Powell for 2 years. And not just West Valley Police. I mean, the Salt Lake County District Attorney said yesterday they've had regular updates with police. And if the DA's office felt there was grounds to arrest Josh Powell, surely the prosecutor would have said so. That's their job. There's still so much we don't know about what evidence West Valley Police have. I guess until we know more about that, it's tough for anyone to make a judgment on what could have been done with Josh Powell. But every indication is that West Valley City Police gave this a more than complete effort for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer Sullivan, what's the general reaction from the community that you've been seeing up there? I'm sure shock is one of the emotions.
People are horrified. They, people hear terrible things happening all over the place, but I think every story that's come out with everything progressing and getting worse and the news just getting more and more tragic, we look at our reader comments and people just say, thanks for reporting that, but I just can't even fathom it.
Hmm. Nate Carlisle, both there and in Utah, what reaction have you seen?
I think that's absolutely correct. I think what has jumped out to a lot of reporters who have covered this is we're not accustomed to someone we all have at least met doing this, doing something like this, or even dying in a manner like this. A lot of us met Josh Powell. I met his boys. I'm staying in the same hotel in Puyallup where I once interviewed Josh Powell and his father. And, been to their house, the boys jumping on my lap as I interviewed their dad one time. I don't want to make this about the reporters, it's about the boys and the families. But as my observation, this has shocked even the reporters.
And this is, there's something different about this case because it's been in the public consciousness for 2 years. And, these are people that... A lot of us have felt like it's kind of glib to say come to know, but at least it's been in our consciousness, and then this happens. So I guess we can connect with what you're saying there. I wonder the comments now from Chuck and Judy Cox. What has stood out to you from those comments now recently?
Chuck and Judy Cox. I'm amazed they're as composed as they are. I think that's what I still observe about them is that they were calm and rational yesterday. They articulated their grief without lashing out at people. Chuck did say that he thinks there should be that mistakes were made by the state of Washington in terms of letting Josh have visitation at all. But even that's a pretty mild comment given the circumstances.
Hmm. Jennifer Sullivan, I've in events like this, usually a sort of a spontaneous memorial is set up. I saw some pictures of something like that at the elementary school there where the two boys attended.
I think folks have been putting flowers, gifts, whatever they can out from the elementary school. Some folks left some items in front of the Cox house. They've done everything they can, whether it's a candlelight vigil, gathered together, you name it.
And what are the police saying that is next? I guess they're planning on what's next. What are they saying about that?
They've been pretty quiet this morning. We're waiting to hear if there's going to be another news conference with the Pierce County Sheriff's Department. Knowing them, there will be. There probably will be something else this morning. And I think as reporters and as people in the community, we just hope that the news doesn't get any worse.
Nate Carlisle, what are the police in the West Valley City Police saying about what's next? And, of course, there's still the case, the original case, Susan Cox Powell missing.
Well, that's right, and that's what we talked to West Valley City Police Chief about yesterday. I guess for lack of a better term, it's status quo as far as finding Susan Powell. They still have detectives assigned to the case. They'll find out if any clues of Susan's disappearance were left behind up here by Josh Powell in the course of what he did Sunday. But they're still trying to find her, and where to go next, I don't know. I can only assume West Valley City Police have some plan or some evidence they're still following up upon.
Jennifer Sullivan, what about the Josh Powell's father, Steve Powell? What are people saying? What are police saying about him?
Oh, I got an email from my editor this morning where we're still trying to come to grips with what to do with Steve Powell now and how to report on him, whether we check into his prior criminal history or is he legitimately a person of interest in Susan's disappearance.
What about the Tribune, Nate Carlisle?
As far as what we're doing today?
With regard to Steve Powell.
Well, I mean, we've been looking at Steve Powell for 2 years. He's not a new character to us. And Steve doesn't want to talk to any reporters right now, we're being told. He has no criminal history. Had a pretty intense divorce case in Washington State back in the 90s that has come up in the Cox Powell custody hearings these last few months. And I've interviewed Steve too, and he was very much like his son, at least in terms of attitude and mannerisms.
What is the scene like there at that home in Grimm? Are people coming to see what it looks like?
Yeah, they're the best they can. A lot of the street's been blocked off. It kind of sits in the tail end of a, not quite a cul-de-sac, but a little loop or circle. And so it's pretty well blocked off, but there have been some people that come up and can kind of get a peek around the corner.
Jennifer Sullivan, what's been your view of what people are they wanting to go and see this this place?
I think that's generally what folks want to do. They'll drive up, they'll try to see what they can, try to get the information they can firsthand, take some pictures of whatever they're seeing and then go. I think some of our finest pictures that we had over the weekend came from witnesses. So I think folks are definitely interested in seeing what's there.
Nate Carlisle, we've been hearing about emails that Josh Powell sent out to several people in the minutes before the fire, and heard a report this morning of a voicemail that someone got. What are you hearing?
Yeah, that's correct. As a matter of fact, I have emails from the Tribune saying ABC News obtained a voicemail left behind. I haven't listened to it myself, but from the text I've seen, it looks like it's pretty much the same thing he said in the email. Goodbye. I'm sorry. I can't live without my boys.
So, Jennifer Sullivan, you mentioned that the TV reporters had to take a moment to compose themselves, especially after they learned of the latest news about the hack marks on the boys. What has been the mood among the reporting community up there?
I think everyone was completely in shock over the weekend, and now it's just trying to compose ourselves and tell the story with sensitivity. Again, we don't want to make this about ourselves, but when you're trying to explain what happened and you hear chop marks and you hear about hatchets, It's just, you can't even comprehend it.
Mm. And finally, we're running at the end of this segment. Start with you, Jennifer Sullivan, on this one. What are a couple of the most important facts, questions that you'll be looking for answers for in the next few days in your reporting?
I think for us, we're still going to keep going through the family custody battle. There's just a lot of comments in the court file. There's just so much in there, and it's just so lengthy. We'd like to find out a little bit more about the worker who was with the boys that day. Obviously, the Department of Social and Health Services haven't released her name. We know where she worked. We'd love to just at least talk to her and talk to her about what happened.
And Nate Carlisle, same question. What are you be especially pursuing the next few days?
Where is Susan Powell? And what information or evidence did the police have about Josh Powell, or didn't they have about Josh Powell? We know they don't have a body, obviously, and obviously don't have a eyewitness, or at least one good enough to make a case against Josh. But I have to think now some more information is going to come out about the police investigation into Josh himself.
We'll leave it there. We have much more in this hour, and you're welcome to comment as well at 1-800-826-1495. We're on Facebook and Twitter as well, and our email address. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Nate Carlisle. Thank you so much to you.
Thank you.
And with Seattle Times reporter Jennifer Sullivan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I'm sure we'll be reading your reports. I believe you both are off to report now, and we appreciate you taking the time. Coming up following a brief break, my recorded conversation from yesterday with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Sheena McFarland. She did a very good recap of this whole situation, sort of put it in context. We're going to remind ourselves of the history of this with Sheena McFarland following a break. And then we have a conversation with Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff. He's been tweeting, as is his wont, and some interesting comments. And we'll be talking with Sherry Hill, spokeswoman for the Children's Administration, the Washington State Department of Social and Health Services. We'll conclude the program with a friend of Susan Powell's, Kirsey Hellowell. Much more to come following this break.
Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
This part of the program, we thought we'd take a look at the history of this whole case with Sheena McFarland, reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Her article headlined, Josh Powell's Lasting Identity Murderer, sets out some of the history of the case. We're all familiar with this, but I thought it'd be a good way to begin this part of the program, is taking a look at some of the history. First of all, Sheena McFarland, welcome to the program. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this began with a couple of people who grew up in similar area, right? Same area. They went to the same high school. This is Josh Powell and Susan Cox.
Absolutely.
So tell us how they met and how they got married.
They met at a singles ward activity for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And even though they went to the same high school, they just never crossed paths. But not long after they met at that activity, they wed at the Portland LDS Temple and moved into an apartment nearby Susan Cox's family and kind of started their life there.
Susan Cox's family, were they living at that point in West Valley City?
No, this is still up in Washington.
This was still up in Washington.
Susan Cox's family has always been up in the Puyallup area.
Okay.
It was Josh Powell's, half of his family moved to Utah.
Okay.
Sometime after they got married.
So they didn't really know each other in high school, but they met, married, in what, early 20s?
Yeah.
And then, I guess they wanted to start a family, figured they didn't have enough money to do that. They needed to earn more.
Right.
Is that what they moved to Utah?
That is. They were managing some, healthcare facilities up in Washington and just not making the money that they need to start a family. And so in order to be closer to Josh Powell's mother and sister who had moved to Utah, they moved down here as well and found a home in West Valley City and started their family, having Charlie and Braden.
What did the in-laws think of Josh Powell, Chuck and Judy Cox?
You know, they thought he was a little off. They thought he had a weird sense of humor. They didn't appreciate that after the two wed that they started showing up very late for family activities, which is something that their daughter had never really done in the past. They kind of described him as being erratic. They silently worried that he had a mental illness of some sort, but they wanted to be supportive of their daughter's marriage and just never brought it up with her.
Hmm. What did the neighbors think of this couple?
You know, it was interesting. You kind of get a different view depending on who you talk to. There are neighbors in West Valley City who just looked at this family as just a sweet, wonderful, loving family. Everyone absolutely loves Susan Cox and have a bad word against her. But some neighbors who Susan opened up to got a little bit of a different picture. They heard Susan's stories about Josh being very controlling and emotionally abusive, as she put it, to them. And many of them counseled her to leave her husband because it just wasn't a good situation for her to be in.
Apparently there's a positive picture as well of Josh Powell. He did teach neighbors woodworking skills and the like.
Absolutely. He seemed very social. He was a guy that liked to talk a lot. He seemed to be very neighborly and very engaged with his neighbors and his neighbor children. But the relationship between he and Susan didn't sound like it was a very good situation for either of them.
What was each of them doing to earn a living?
Josh had several different things that he was doing as a computer programmer for a trucking company. He ran some website design stuff from home. Susan was a stockbroker, and she was joking with her friends that she never in a million years thought that she would be in such a career, but she trained for it, and that was what she was doing.
And what did it look like? Who was bringing in the money?
It very much looked like Susan Powell was bringing in the money. At some point, she actually opened up a separate banking account and started saving money that Josh didn't have access to, for kind of in preparation of this relationship not working out in the end.
So at least people connected with Susan Cox, their understanding was that she was planning an escape route, you might call it, a route for life after Josh.
Yeah, she would basically set up a deadline in her mind that if that relationship wasn't repaired by their anniversary in early 2010, that she was going to leave. And she had mentioned this to several people. None of them were sure if Josh knew of this deadline as well, but she had done a lot of work in getting them into counseling and was fasting and praying and trying to make this relationship work.
Hmm. Religion became a point of contention, did it?
It did. They were both active in the LDS church early on, but Josh stopped going. Susan continued taking her children with him, but Josh would come up with excuses not to go or just flat out refuse to attend, which was a major point of contention between the two.
And financial pressures and arguments.
Absolutely. They filed bankruptcy and claimed more than $200,000 in debts that they owed. So there was definitely a lot of financial strain on the couple.
Mm. And as you've said, we've read reports that those, you might call it on Susan's side, saw Josh's controlling. What do people on Josh's side say about that?
You know, we've talked to a few people who said that he was just a really engaged father. His mother and sister wrote briefs to the court saying that he really spent a lot of time with his sons, really loved them, really worked hard to make sure that they were happy. We've talked to work colleagues who just never saw the side of Josh and just thought he was a good colleague to have, and those kind of attitudes that just really focused a lot around him being a good father.
And, of course, by December 7th, 2009, the couple has two children, Charlie and Braden, who at this point were, what, 5 and 3?
Yeah, right about that.
So December 7th, 2009, Susan Cox Powell disappears, and you write her purse and keys were still at home. Josh
right.
Powell immediately becomes I don't know if immediately, but the police describe him as a person of interest. What did he say happened on the night of December 7th, 2009?
He says that he took his children on a winter camping trip in freezing temperatures to the West Desert, and the last time he saw his wife, he was going to bed, and he was leaving, and then when he came back, she was gone, and that he felt that she just left their family.
Hmm. And he maintained steadily after that, did he not, that she had left the family?
Absolutely. In an interview that one of my colleagues did when he visited Josh Powell up in Washington, the quote was something to the effect of, "People are going to chew her up like hamburger when she comes back." Josh Powell father, Steve Powell, asserted that she had run off with a man from Utah named Steve Kosher, who had been missing a few months after her disappearance, and contended those two were in Brazil together.
It appears, it's obvious from subsequent events, the police department did not believe his story or his
right.
assertions. He refused to meet with them.
He did on several occasions. There were a few times when he would say that he would meet and then he wouldn't show up. At least three times he refused to be interviewed. Instead, he hired a lawyer and wouldn't cooperate with police.
The police, I guess, I don't know what theories they were operating on, but we had this incident not too long ago where they were out in the West Desert doing some digging. They apparently believed that they had a lead.
Absolutely. There have been a couple of different desert searches that they have done, and they found some charred wood that may have human remains on it. They've not released any testing results from that, but they have not found anything at this point.
Then in September of 2011, the father, Josh Powell's father, Steve Powell, was arrested, charged with possession of child pornography. Then subsequent events led to Josh Powell's two boys being taken into state custody. Tell us a little bit about what happened there.
Well, discovered on several of the computers that had been confiscated were images that Steve Powell had taken video of young girls in the neighborhood without their knowledge in sexually explicit ways. And so when he was arrested, the boys were immediately removed from the home. They spent about 5 days in state custody. And during that time, Chuck and Judy Cox, Susan Powell's parents, filed for custodial rights. Those children were granted that. And so the boys have been staying with the Coxes since September.
Chuck and Judy Cox and most of that side of the family, did they continue to believe that Josh Powell was involved?
You know, in the beginning, they didn't. But as time went on, they became increasingly sure that their son-in-law was involved somehow in her disappearance. It became a very contentious relationship between the two. There were restraining orders filed against both Chuck Cox and Josh Powell to stay away from each other. And then the custody battle, of course, has been a very heated situation.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, there are people on Josh Powell's side who supported him.
Yes.
Now, the very recent events which led up to this tragic event, Josh Powell, apparently there was child pornography found on his computers, or because of the fact they were found on his father's computers, he was going to have to undergo a psychosexual examination?
Well, and actually, the West Valley City Police released information that they had found sexually explicit images. They didn't clarify any further than that, but sexually explicit images on Josh Powell's computer, and that was enough to give the judge pause in Washington to order the psychosexual evaluation and a polygraph test in regards to those images. But we don't know if those were child pornography or what they were.
But they were clear these sexually explicit images were found on Josh's computer.
Correct. That's what the West Valley City Police say.
Okay. So I suppose a part of this ruling on child custody included visitation with the father.
It did. He was able to have twice weekly visits with his father. Originally, those were in kind of a common house where families come to have those kind of visits, but the Coxes okayed visits at Josh's house in order to try and make Charlie and Braden a little bit more comfortable.
Now, on Sunday when this happened, the children were accompanied by a social worker.
Correct.
And that was part of it. They had to be supervised. That social worker had to be there.
Absolutely.
Backtracking just a little bit, what has Josh Powell been saying? Has he communicated at all through social media or anything? I know he hasn't been giving many media interviews, but what has he been saying about the whole custody battle and anything else?
He hasn't been giving many media interviews at all or really speaking out publicly, but he did file a brief with the court saying that he had been put in a difficult circumstance because of his wife's disappearance, and he felt like people had been giving him a really difficult time and were being very abusive toward him in implicating him in his wife's disappearance. He mentioned that he had been standing strong for his sons, even though he'd been facing these hardships, and really said that the having his children in the Cox home, he worried would poison them against him, and really fought hard to get full custody of his children back.
And we all remember that Steve Powell and Josh Powell released parts of a diary, did they not?
They did.
Susan's diary. That they purported that these passages prove their theory that she had run off with a man.
Right.
And on the other side, the Coxes say this is taken out of context, I believe, and didn't prove anything.
Absolutely. Yeah, the Coxes were very upset that they had released these very private journals of Susan Powell's and very much claimed that they were not contextualized. Mm-hmm.
And this all led, of course, to the tragic events of Sunday. We're going to cover this in greater detail and get to listeners' comments as well. Sheena McFarland, anything else about the history and the leading up to this that we should say?
You know, I don't have anything much to add. I think this has just been a horrific series of events that started out with just a very bizarre missing persons case and just spiraled out of control. And I don't think anyone was expecting Sunday's events to unfold the way that they did. And it's just absolutely tragic that those two boys lost their lives.
Mm-hmm. What are the police saying? Are they hopeful that in any way what happened to Susan will ever be known now?
You know, they say they still have an open case, and they are working hard to try and get some more information. But at this point, they're not releasing much information, saying because it's an open case, they're still keeping everything confidential.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Sheena McFarland, reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, wrote an article giving us a history of the case. We appreciate her coming on to help us remember. Of course, we're all familiar with much of this, but I think it helps to put it in context. Sheena McFarland, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And, of course, we're reading about these tragic events. On Sunday, of course, the police are saying that Josh Powell killed himself and his two sons. Another tragic chapter in this ongoing story. Susan Cox Powell still missing, and several communities in shock over this in Utah and in Washington State. We've been talking about this. We'll continue with this for the rest of the hour. And you're welcome to join the conversation at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. Our email is upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. We bring in now Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff. And Attorney General, thanks so much for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
I noticed a tweet that you had sent out, a very interesting take on this, well, a couple. And I just want to get your general reaction to these events on Sunday.
Well, I was obviously, like everybody else, just blown away. I mean, my first response, and then as I said to my wife, I can't repeat on the radio. I mean, I just this gut reaction to such evil. You know, everybody's used that word a lot. And as Attorney General, I've in my 12th year, and I've been a prosecutor most of my life, I've seen a lot of really bad, ugly, horrible things, and the people who you would think were inhumane. I've seen prison murders and all kinds of things based on race and other things. And I'll tell you, this one just, to me, took the cake. I use the word fiendish because that's about as evil as you can get. It's just diabolical what he did to do that in the end. I mean, I can understand, I suppose. I've worked a lot with people who want to take their own lives, and you can kind of understand in his situation, but to take those little boys through and to do it in that way, just once again makes me, you know, kind of worry about our situation in this world. And you may see so much ugly and you start worrying about the good, but there is good. And that's why I decided to do a second text.
Mm-hmm. And quote this, Josh Powell, malevolence is a reminder that legal criminal system can be inadequate. Hope lies in family, faith, and community.
Right. Well, you know, in law enforcement, people kind of expect us to, solve everything, to protect everybody. Sorry. Mm-hmm. And we try, but sometimes we don't get it done. And, you know, notwithstanding all the tools and things we do to try and protect people, there are other times when you just can't. You can't save everybody, and we couldn't protect these boys.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point is that the community needs to recognize that you can't just place trust in law enforcement, that our society and the evil that's out there and the good that's out there can overcome and triumph the bad if we all get involved, if we look out for each other and our families. And there was a lot of good people around this story, and I just immediately, as I thought of those boys, I thought of my conversations with Chuck Cox and how much he loved his grandkids and how hurt he was at the loss of his daughter and how he was fighting within the system as hard as he could to try and get those boys safe because he knew they were in danger. I don't know that he anticipated this, but he knew that they weren't in a good place and that people were working to try and do that. And that's all I can say is we just need to do more, even beyond family to communities and neighborhoods and religions and social groups, you know, looking out for each other. And that's how we can, you know, please triumph over the rotten out there.
And the emotions you're feeling, I'm sure, I'm guessing that many in law enforcement are feeling that today, wishing they could have done more, but knowing their limits.
Oh, absolutely, I'm sure. And I wasn't as close as so many were, who were working so hard. You know, I've had, obviously, lots of emails and texts and tweets back to me and people questioning law enforcement and shouldn't he have been in jail and why didn't you charge him? And even some people who have got it completely wrong that just disgust me to suggest that somehow law enforcement, by dogging Josh Powell or whatever, that led him to do this and somehow trying to justify what he did, which there is no justification. But we have to try and explain, you know, we in law enforcement want to charge and, you know, and if, believing, as I do, that Josh Powell did kill his wife, even before, you know, what he did on Sunday. But, you know, we want to have the best possible case. We want to know how to charge it correctly. We need to know if we can charge capital homicide, what type of homicide we're dealing with. We want to have all the facts. And obviously having a body is very critical to that. And so we do everything we can to try and find the body so that we can charge it correctly. And that's, I'm sure, what was, you know, the delay in this case. Now, sometimes you don't, and sometimes you end up having to charge without it. But and so I'm sure there's a lot of second guessing within West Valley and the DA's office, and people will Monday morning quarterback. But I totally support what they were doing and their efforts, and they had leads, and they thought they were going to get there. And of course, nobody anticipated that it would turn out like this. Although, you know, I got to tell you, just the other night, a couple of nights before Josh Powell's murder of his kids. You know, they had the pictures of him in court when they were dealing with the custody of the kids. And there was, in law enforcement, after a while, you get to look at someone and you can see the dark circles under his eyes and almost the 1,000-yard stare kind of thing going on. And I was thinking, you know, so this guy is messed up. I certainly didn't anticipate what he was going to do. Nobody did. And yet, I just felt like something was really, really wrong there.
I wanted to ask you about the process because, as you say, there's some Monday morning quarterbacking going on, and wondering what maybe the prosecutors and police should have done. What's the process there? The prosecutor takes the lead on that in determining whether they have a case?
It's a collaborative effort, absolutely. You've got to rely on law enforcement to do their investigation, but you're constantly in contact and collaboration with the district attorney because they're the one that's going to charge the case. And so, you know, obviously it's up to them, and they'll come out at the right time with all the facts because people wondering, what did you have on him? What, you know, and why didn't you charge? They'll be able to explain all that. I'm absolutely confident in that. But again, yeah, it's an important collaborative effort, and there'll be those. We do it all the time in my office. We have the luxury in my office of having the law enforcement agents who do the investigation and the prosecutors all within the same office. We work to collaborate very closely all the time. Where you have, for example, in this case, West Valley Police, and then obviously other police up in Washington looking at other aspects of the case as things moved along. And then you have a DA here who needs to pretty much wait for the investigation, but will answer and respond to that. And so I'm sure there were multiple meetings where you have, I'm sure, hundreds of years of experience in law enforcement and prosecution coming together, pulling out the criminal code, figuring out the elements, what evidence do we have, what more do we need, can we charge it now? I mean, I'm sure they went through all of that. That's what you do. But, you know, in prosecutions, you don't want to charge somebody unless you have a substantial likelihood that you're going to be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. I know some prosecutors say, well, what the heck, we'll just charge him. You know, 50-50 chance of winning. We don't do that here in Utah. The DA doesn't do that. You want to have substantial evidence because you want to prove the case. You can destroy someone's life just by charging them. You want to be sure that you have the right person, and you want to be able to have a conviction that's going to, especially if you end up charging a capital homicide, it'll then be 20 years in appeals that you have, you've done it all right. And that's what they were trying to do in this case.
Running out of time here, but I wanted to pass along a question that I had from a friend. I'm sure reflects some feelings of others. And this friend was sort of wondering about the whole structure and the rules that we put in place for law enforcement, for prosecution. They were wondering if we are forcing agencies with the rules to be so careful that perhaps we're erring too much on the side of caution.
You know, sometimes we feel that way. I'll tell you that in law enforcement we do, but there's a reason for those rules in place. We are a rule of law nation, but we also have that important balancing test. Justice demands that we protect individuals' civil rights, including those we suspect of horrific deeds. And we, you know, we never want to charge someone inappropriately or incorrectly. And sometimes we do make mistakes. There's no doubt about that. But we, especially when you're dealing with a serious crime like we have here, we believe with Susan Powell being murdered by her husband, that it is, you want to do it right. And yeah, there are rules in place, but it's good. You know, it keeps police in check. It keeps us from overcharging or mischarging sometimes. And so it's not a perfect system. And in situations like this, people, you really start wondering and second guessing, because, you know, you will always wonder, could we have saved those boys?
And the police, of course, and they've mentioned this, they've made this clear, they still have an open case with Susan Cox Powell and her disappearance. You've been in that role as prosecutor. What will the next steps be as they try to decide what to do going forward?
Well, they'll continue to work. Obviously, now that Josh Powell is dead, we will question whether an attorney-client privilege still exists with his attorneys. It'll be, you know, finding out if there's anything else there. I mean, you have obviously some ties in with his dad. Some questions arisen now about, you know, from things that Stephen Powell himself has said about Susan. That's why you say there is an ongoing investigation as to whether there was some other involvement beyond Josh, and so they have to continue that through, and they will still continue to diligently search. Unfortunately, you know, Josh Powell being something less than the monster that he is, he might have led some suggestions so that the body could be found and there could be some closure for this family.
Mm-hmm. You say you know the Coxes. You've talked to Chuck Cox.
Yes.
I can only imagine what they must be going through in this time. What would you say we as a community can do for the Cox and for those related to Josh Powell, who had no culpability in this?
Well, you follow the Coxes' perfect example. When I met Chuck, he was out at an important rally with Elizabeth and Eric Smart and her dad and others, because already now, knowing the heartbreak and the terror of losing a child, he's out there stepping up, saying we need to do more, looking out for each other and to bring children home safely, whatever their age, adult or minor children. We need to, you know, there's so many things in place in order to better protect our young ones and our families and to combat evil in this world, and that's what he's doing. Mm-hmm. He doesn't take his hurt inwardly. They step out and help people, and that's what we all need to do. And shows like this really help, and I appreciate you talking about it.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. I know emotions are raw for you, as they are for many of us. Mark Shurtleff, Utah's Attorney General, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Coming up following a brief break, we're going to be talking with Sherry Hill, a spokeswoman for the Children's Administration at the Department of Social and Health Services for Washington State. And of course, there are questions that people are raising about the process, maybe what should have been done, that could have been done perhaps to prevent this from the point of view of child caseworkers and the custody issues. We're going to talk a bit about that. And to conclude the program, we'll have a conversation with Susan Cox Powell's friend Kiersey Halliwell. That's all coming up following a brief break.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Thanks for staying with us for Access Utah. Of course, we're spending the hour working through the emotions, the shock from the tragic events of Sunday. Police say that Josh Powell killed himself and his two sons in a house fire. even word coming out that there were hatchet marks on the two sons, and we're trying to come to terms with this as best we can in this hour. And you're welcome to comment at 1-800-826-1495. We'll conclude the program in just a few minutes with Susan Coxpal friend Kirsi Hallowell. The search goes on for Susan Coxpal. Right now we bring in Sherry Hill, spokeswoman for Children's Administration at the Department of Social and Health Services for Washington State. And thanks so much for joining us today.
Yes, good morning.
And I see in the papers that your department has been anticipating some questions that inevitably would come out in a case like this. The department, as any agency would do, does their best and follows the rules, but there's always some second-guessing and looking at this when a tragedy like this happens. And I'm sure you've seen these reports that Chuck and Judy Cox are saying that, that the system failed their grandsons, and it would have been appropriate to suspend Josh Powell's court-ordered supervision given the psychosexual evaluation that he'd been ordered to do. From the point of view of the agency, what procedures were followed? Will there be review that will be happening in this case?
Yes, we'll be conducting a fatality review as we wrap up the investigation that we have currently underway.
And I guess in this particular situation, I'm assuming the rules were followed. From the department's point of view, should have been extra scrutiny in this case, and perhaps a visitation at a neutral ground?
Well, this is something that we didn't take lightly, and we worked with all people involved, including the law enforcement, the courts, the family, to come up with the best visitation. And, of course, the court ultimately ruled on it. But we had pulled together all the information and recommendations from many parties. So it wasn't just a decision made by one person.
The Cox family is saying that they feel that the rules should be changed. Of course, if we look back, the department followed the rules as they were. The Cox family is saying the rules perhaps should be changed. Would the department support that?
Well, as we do the fatality review, we're going to look at policies. We're going to look at all the actions taken in this these children's cases. The one thing that I should point out, this was court-ordered, and we were following what ultimately we had as a court order. So in order to change that, we would have needed to go back to court and make those changes. And the other thing is, you know, when we have maybe a 1 or 2 hour visit, you can go to a neutral location pretty easy. But when you have a 4 hour visit, we need to make sure that the children and the family are in a good, comfortable situation. Like, you wouldn't go to a restaurant for 4 hours. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times, you know, we're going to go to the home or to possibly maybe a home of a friend or something. But again, we're going to have a situation where children can visit with their parent, and it's the least restrictive, least intrusive, and it's something where children can bond with their parents.
And this was set up to be a supervised visit.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's the most restrictive. We do have supervision where a person just checks on the family about every 15 minutes. This was directly supervised at all times. So that person needed to have their eye on all the parties that were visiting.
Mm-hmm. That this must be a traumatic time for that caseworker to have this happen.
Yes, the visitation worker is pretty traumatized.
Mm-hmm. What will happen with him or her? Get counseling? What will happen there?
Yes. We're offering peer support where we pull together all the people involved with the case and really offer peer support for everyone. Mm. And since we're all working in social services, people are all trained and geared for that. So.
This must be a traumatic event for the whole department.
Actually, it is. Mm. Everyone is really affected. And I think just as anyone who's watched these children in the news and known about their situation, I think everyone's heart goes out to the family and definitely is such a tragedy for these children, and we are all feeling that.
Finally, what is the process? In a case like this, you said there, I would imagine there's an automatic review. What is that review? What form does that take?
We'll bring in professionals who mirror the same discipline of the professionals who were involved with this case, but people who were not directly involved or had knowledge of it. So they're going to be able to look at all aspects. So, for example, we will have somebody from law enforcement on our review team, and we'll have probably a psychologist and, of course, other social workers and whatnot. And they'll sit down and really evaluate all steps taken, decisions made, policies followed, anything that might outline what we had done, and they'll make recommendations for any changes.
We'll leave it there. Sherry Hill, spokeswoman for the Children's Administration at the Washington State Department of Social and Health Services. Thanks so much for taking some time to be with us today.
Thank you.
And, of course, we're covering the tragic events of Sunday. Police say Josh Powell killed himself and his children. Ongoing tragic chapter and an ongoing story. Of course, Susan Coxpell is still missing. And we'll talk a bit about that up next. A conversation from earlier today that I had with a friend of Susan Coxpell, Kirsi Helliwell. She has organized a Facebook site and some searches for Susan Powell. Here's that conversation to conclude the program with Kirsi Helliwell. This part of the program, we're now talking with Kirsi Helliwell, a friend of Susan Coxpell, and who's organized some Facebook campaigns and searches. Probably seen her in the media commenting. Kirsi Helliwell, appreciate you taking some time today to talk to us.
Thank you.
What was your initial reaction to the tragic events of Sunday?
Just absolute horror. It felt like the day that Susan disappeared all over again, just like a nightmare that couldn't be true.
For you, does this confirm in any way Josh Powell's guilt in Susan's disappearance?
Well, of course, we don't know for sure if he killed Susan, but if he's capable of killing two innocent little boys in such a horrific way, then he's certainly capable of killing his wife.
What do you think should be next in the search for Susan Powell? That's what still remains, the mystery of what happened to Susan Powell and where she is.
Well, people need to realize that she's still missing. Her boys' terrible death has not changed that. She's still out there. We still need to find her. We still need to focus on finding her just as much as we ever did.
Do you think this lessens the chances that we will find her?
I know everybody's thinking that because they think Josh died and he took all answers with him. But I think there's a very big possibility that he had help and other people know about what happened.
Hmm. So what will you be doing? What do you think people ought to be doing next? Imagine the police will make their plans. What about you and the friends surrounding you?
Well, we're just trying to deal with processing everything. I've been so busy that I haven't had a chance to sit down and grieve and realize what really happened. I'm sure we'll probably be traveling up to Washington if a funeral happens in the next few days. But as far as Susan goes, we're still asking people, spread the word, email her flyers to everybody, print one out, carry it on your car. Just please keep looking for Susan, because we need to find her. And her parents especially need to have answers about where their daughter is and what happened to her.
What's the best? Is there a Facebook page up? What's a good contact point for people who want to help?
Yes, we have a Facebook page called the Friends and Family of Susan Cox Powell. And then there's also a Facebook group called Friends and Family of Susan Powell. There's also the Find Susan Twitter account. It's called @FindSusan, the @ and then Find Susan. And there's also a blog called Service for Susan, where we put all the news for people that don't get on Facebook.
I want to ask you your memories of Susan Cox Powell and her sons. First of all, I wonder if you'd respond to something that Nathan Leach said, Texas cousin of Josh Powell. He's saying that he believes there was pressure brought to bear. He doesn't condone what Josh Powell did, but he said there are circumstances, and he points out a couple of those Facebook sites, I think including the one that you're running. I wonder if you'd respond to that.
Well, I think it's totally ridiculous, because for one thing, Chuck Cox has asked me for the past 2 years to keep any negative or accusatory comments towards Josh off of those Facebook pages. And myself and the other volunteer administrators and moderators have worked overtime to keep all of those comments about Josh off the page. We ask people over and over, please don't be accusatory. Don't accuse Josh or anyone else of anything, because Chuck Cox had asked us not to. So for him to say that the Facebook pages, at least the ones that I'm an administrator of, bullied him in any way is just totally ridiculous. And the second response to that is that Josh had his choices. He had the choice to cooperate with police from the beginning, and he didn't do that. He had the choice to cooperate with police at any time. He could have chosen to let her children have visitation with the Coxes often, so maybe they wouldn't have tried to go after custody of the boys. He also had the choice to murder his children or not. I don't care how miserable a person is, there is absolutely no excuse of any kind for murdering children.
Finally, I just maybe get some memories how you would like us to remember Susan and the children, Charlie and Braden. How did you meet Susan?
We met through our church. She was a member of my ward when they first moved here to Washington. We met her the first Sunday she came to church.
And what are some of your, you know, we don't know exactly what happened to Susan, but how should people think of Susan Powell?
She's a wonderful, kind, friendly person. She's the kind of person that would go up to you and introduce herself, and then you'd feel like you'd known her for your whole life after 5 minutes. She loved to give service to others. She loved her boys more than anything in the world. She was fun-loving and mischievous.
And what about the boys? I assume you interacted with Charlie and Braden.
Right. We did a lot of things with their family. I babysat them. I fed them. We spent a lot of time together. And the boys are very cute. They were the apple of Susan's eye. They loved her, and they loved exploring. They loved playing outside. They loved going on family adventures. They loved looking at bugs and doing art projects.
Moving forward, of course, everyone connected is in shock, be grieving, but specifically with respect to Susan Cox Powell, give us the site again and what you would like people to do in terms of finding out what happened to her.
For people on Facebook, the main page is Friends and Family of Susan Cox Powell. That's where we post the main news and links. Also, there's a blog for those who don't get on Facebook. It's called Service for Susan. And the Twitter account is Find Susan.
Very good. We appreciate you very much taking some time today. It must be a very hard time for you. Kiersey Hallowell, friend of Susan Cox Powell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And bye now. And that concludes Access Utah for today. Thanks for listening. Coming up tomorrow at 9 o'clock, One World, Many Stories. Ordinary Utahns tell their personal stories.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.